Welcome to the CRE Exchange podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in this space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance.
I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research at Altus Group, a leading provider of commercial real estate intelligence, here to provide you with the latest news and trends in the commercial real estate market. I'm excited to have a special guest on with me today, Chris Famuglio, Managing Director of Data and Research at Madison International Realty, to talk about the real estate secondaries market. Chris brings over 15 years of experience in commercial real estate data and analytics. Before joining Madison, he held leadership and analytical roles at 10X Commercial, formerly Auction.com, and at CW Capital. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm excited to have you on. We've never done an episode on secondaries before. Now, some of our listeners might be familiar with Madison, but how about you give us a bit of an elevator pitch? Who are your major clients, or what group would you lump that in, and what problems are you trying to solve for them?
So Madison International Realty, we are a closed-end fund business that operates in the U.S., Europe, and the U.K., specializing in what we call direct secondaries and liquidity solutions. So what that is, providing capital solutions to owners of portfolios and properties, and sometimes platforms at a continuation vehicle level. We typically do LP solutions, so think recapitalizations, partner buyouts, end of fund life situations. But what differentiates us is we're not doing that when you think of traditional secondaries, buying parts of a fund. That's not really our business. We're buying directly into the property or the portfolio itself. So a little bit of a different paradigm there. And then we're a closed-end fund business, and we have investors across the U.S., Europe, and Asia, major sovereign wealth funds, pension funds, et cetera, like that. So institutional capital base.
So I think you did a nice job of explaining where Madison fits, but I think for the meat of our conversation, we might need to explain in layman's terms what the secondaries market is. So for our audience, how does Madison define a secondary transaction? And maybe how is that different than just, say, buying a property outright or investing in a fund at a primary stage? How would you lay that out for us?
Yeah, it's a great place to start. So typically we're entering into a property or portfolio in a minority position. Sometimes that can get up to as high as 70 or 80% ownership in some sort of joint venture structure or some sort of partnership structure, but we're never buying 100% of a property outright. That's the first major differentiation. Now with that, we typically, since we're providing liquidity to some fractional interest in a joint venture, that comes at a discounted entry price. So what we like to do is we target properties and portfolios that are healthy operationally, high occupancies, right, good stable rent growth and credit. But what's going on is there's just some sort of fracturing in the ownership structure, whether it's gone on too long and someone needs liquidity because they need to recycle this into something else, or there could be something as simple as a life event. We've seen joint venture structures where someone's going through a major life event and they need liquidity, and so we can act as a solution. And so all sorts of situations arise, and most of real estate is fractionally owned at this point, given how institutional and large it's scaled in nominal terms. And so there's just a lot of opportunity then for people who need liquidity and otherwise perfectly healthy assets and operating fundamentals. And that's the meat of what we're trying to do.
I know it might be difficult to put some actual numbers to this, although if you have some, would love to hear them. How big is this market? I know sizing isn't straightforward, but I want to hear a little bit about how Madison thinks about the total addressable market for secondaries.
It's a great question. And the data nerd in me shudders to think in TAM, because it's often fool's gold. You can make anything look like it has a giant TAM. But if you think about it, real estate transaction volume itself runs about, call it $550 billion per year in the U.S. per the RCA data, depending on how many years you look back and whatnot. And so even if just 10% of that is a secondary transaction, right, it's a lot. Now, I know there's a good data set that Ares puts together that is a little bit smaller. They targeted, I think they have $20 billion was the 2025 volume, but I'm not quite sure how they put that data set together, so I wouldn't speak to it. The partial interest data set. From RCA is significantly higher than that. But the way we view it is secondaries is not often accurately captured in the data because it's inherently nuanced by the complicated nature of the ownership structures. And most commercial real estate now is owned in some sort of a joint structure, and that all of those offer opportunity for our strategy should a misalignment of interest present itself.
And so where does Madison fit in all that? Are you guys one of the larger players?
Yeah, so I would say we are the first and preeminent. We popularized, and Ron Dickerman, our founder, created the strategy of direct secondaries, I would say, into properties and portfolios. Fund secondaries business has been around for a bit, and I think the secondaries business and private equity predated real estate by a little bit. But in terms of applying that methodology to real estate, Madison was really one of the pioneers of that. And now there's other firms that are also applying secondary strategy. I mentioned Ares' data set earlier. They are also a secondaries player, but we view ourselves as the pioneers and the specialists in this space. You know, we're the only ones doing solely this.
So I know you kind of touched on a little bit, but are some of the other reasons that the secondaries market needs to exist in real estate at all? Do you think this is a product of this unique environment or the fact that some ownership structures are becoming more complicated? What do you think is the reason for that?
Yeah, I think it's just the maturation of the asset class itself. As things get more complicated, as things get more, you know, literally nominal value-wise larger, you think about some of these data center deals, they're a billion plus for a single asset. It inherently needs to be fractionalized across more owners. And as that fractionalization occurs, there's more complicated structures and more need for secondary transactions. Not everyone is always going to be able to work within the same closed-end structure the all the way through. It's just an impossible reality. And so, you know, that's what we're looking for.
Now, when you're explaining this industry or this niche to folks, is there a particular misconception that you hear about secondaries when you talk about it? Or if you could dig into some of those, I'd love to hear them.
I think the first misconception is people assume there's distress in the asset and the property. They hear secondary and they assume something's gone wrong.
Yeah.
And that's the reason why there's a liquidity need. And so that we're doing distressed investing. And that's not at all our business plan. It's about finding what are otherwise core and core plus assets and return profiles and getting a little bit of additional return for that liquidity premium of entering the complicated structure. So that's probably the first misconception. The other one is how do you realize that discount if you're entering in a secondary position? How do you then realize that value creation? And it's because when we enter, we're typically driving for control rights, major decision control rights, governance controls, and that's part of what comes with the price of liquidity. And so then we're able to help navigate the exit. If we're unable to secure those sorts of rights, which happens on occasion if we're a smaller fraction of a deal or in an asset class that doesn't lend itself to that, we're looking for really strong exit alignment, some sort of closed-end structure that has a hard date that works within our timeframes or something like that.
Oh, we'll get into some of the individual deal mechanics a little bit later in our conversation, but I'm curious to hear, you've heard a lot about growth in the secondaries market in recent years, and I think a lot of that could be a product of the rate environment. Do you think that this is cyclical, or is it just, you know, you mentioned that it's just as the asset class grows nominally, there is an opening here no matter what? What do you attribute to some of the recent growth?
I think it's both. I think there is a natural long-term institutionalization and maturation of the asset class that over time, secondaries will grow as a natural part of that liquidity ecosystem. Now, that said, the current cycle and the kind of fracturing of the current liquidity environment post-rate hike cycle is definitely made the current environment more fertile for secondaries. And so I think that's been a near-term accelerant of what is otherwise a longer-term trend.
Do you think you guys will have to reinvent your pitch as if the environment normalizes? You know, I say this kind of half laughing because the 10-year treasury yield has blown out 50 basis points in the last month. Who knows when it's going to actually come down? But do you think that if the environment normalizes or other sources of liquidity come back, that this is going to force the pitch to reinvent itself?
I think we've been speaking like in very broad generalities, and yeah, each sector underneath the sort of broad macro environment is going through its own differentiated cycle. So that's part of the beauty of how we operate is we're not pure into one sector we can move across as we see the opportunity evolve. And so that's what we'll do as the market evolves. We'll look for where the most opportunity for us to combine the growth characteristics we're looking for on the go forward business plan with the opportunity to provide liquidity in the near term.
And you're speaking to different property sectors, right?
Yes.
And where are you guys looking right now? What are some of the trends that you're seeing in individual sectors?
Yeah, it's a great question. So right now, we're very actively looking in the seniors housing space to deploy capital. There's a few factors for that. Speaking to the liquidity need side, if you think about the journey the asset class has been on, it had a period of elevated supply in the late 2010s. I'm talking like 2015, 16, 17, in that range. And right as that supply wave was starting to taper off, we got hit by the pandemic and you had a real disruption to the operating fundamentals of seniors housing. And so as a result of that, you have a lot of fatigued capital from previous vintages in this sector who are really just looking to either get out or recapitalize, recalibrate, redeploy, whatever it may be. But there's a lot of tired capital that's gone through this long experience over the last few years. And then we combine that with when we look at the go forward for seniors housing, we're nearing an inflection point on the demographics where the number of 80-year-olds is going to rise at a rate that's 4x the overall, even maybe even higher if overall population growth slows. But we're going to see an outsized population growth trend in this specific demographic. And given the rate environment, development is not really penciling. And so we like the go forward fundamentals. At the same time, there is a fatigued capital base that is in need of liquidity. And so we view this as a really attractive sector for us to be operating in right now.
You find any kind of attractive points in some of the core or the original four sectors? Anything you guys see there?
Yeah, so our most recent transaction in the U.S. and our flagship fund was a multifamily transaction in California. Multifamily is really interesting. It varies across market. When you think about different metros, the experience of the fundamentals and the capital stacks in the Sun Belt over the last, call it 5 years, has been very different than those in the Northeast and the Midwest. So multifamily is a space we're looking at as well, but it's much more nuanced and by market and submarket, given how the supply wave was very disparate in that sector.
Yeah, that and values have swung wildly over the last few years. So I can totally see how folks are looking for that.
Yeah. And to that point, the wild, volatile swings in values creates vintage differentiation. And those vintage differentiations are another source of liquidity need. If you think about a multifamily investor from 2021, the cap rate environment has shifted significantly. It's likely that the operating fundamentals of that property are fine. They're probably mid-90s percent occupancy. And while rent growth has decelerated, it's probably still fairly modest.
Outpacing expenses. Yeah.
And so there's nothing wrong with that property, but the vintage that property was purchased in may create a liquidity need.
Very interesting. Now, that kind of same period, 2021 heading into 2022, and then you get to the beginning of the rate hiking cycle. I came across one of your pieces that you authored for PREA, I think probably in early 2023, about some of those liquidity constraints, about the role of secondaries. I mean, I think you touched on non-traded REITs, open-ended funds. I know that that's not the core of what you guys work on. You do a lot of LP-focused work, but I think some of our audience would be interested in that. So do you want to spend a few minutes giving us an overview of the thesis of that piece and then maybe kind of what's changed through today?
Yeah, absolutely. So the thesis of that piece was really we had seen a fracturing in liquidity, and one of the epicenters for it were these NTR and OEF structures. And then at the time, what we had seen was there had been a rapid shift in valuations in kind of public REIT equities. Even private market metrics like CPPI had adjusted a little faster, and we were seeing valuations lag on the NTR and the OEFs. And at the time, because of that, they had a very attractive, perceptible cap rate you could exit, it created a huge redemption queue. And that added to an already disrupted commercial real estate liquidity cycle. We were already seeing transaction volumes and lending volumes decline significantly in this period. And so now we were also seeing redemption queues, which took this core money out of the market because they couldn't pour forward to new investments. They had to meet redemptions. Since that time, a few things have changed, but there still is a general disruption to commercial real estate liquidity. So what we have seen is the redemption queues have alleviated for most of the NTRs and the OEFs in the real estate space. Private credit's another matter that's been going on in the headlines, but probably not a topic for our discussion today. But in the US, at least, the NTRs and the OFs, the redemption queues have alleviated for the most part. They're not yet seeing inflows, though. We're not seeing inflows into their structures yet. So it's a little bit of a stasis. In looking at some of those other metrics I mentioned, we are seeing loan issuance significantly improve. That's something we observed throughout 2025 and led to our internal liquidity index actually turning higher throughout the course of the year. And then in Q4, we finally saw transaction volume start to take a step towards recovery. I mean, we're still down, I think, 38% from peak levels, but definitely better than the 55% plus we were down from the peak a few years ago.
And you're just talking about
overall RCA transaction volume. Yeah,
yeah, we're seeing some of this stuff in the data that we track through Reonomy as well. It certainly came back toward the end of 2025. And, you know, you saw dollar volumes creep up in 2024, but just a couple, inflation and, but the, you know, number of properties trading was down, even if the nominal dollars were up. So I definitely see it. And I am curious to dig in a little bit about that liquidity index. It's proprietary, internal. Can you tell us a little bit more about what specifically that's measuring? And if you're comfortable sharing some of the things that go into that, I'd love to hear some.
So as liquidity solutions provider, we thought it would be important if we had our own view of liquidity conditions.
Makes sense.
And what the goal of the index is to give that holistic view. So you can look at transaction volume individually or fundraising volume individually. The index is designed to measure all of these things in concert. And so mathematically, it's similar to an ISM index, if anyone's familiar with that. Instead of baseline to 50, I just baselined it to zero for clarity. Above zero, conditions are improving. Below zero, they're getting worse. And then the further you are away from that zero bound towards 100 or minus 100, the stronger the breadth of that improvement or contraction.
This is measured from a prior period, right?
Yeah. So what it does is it goes back to, I think 2007 is the furthest I publish it back. I have some earlier data sets, but they're not as clean. But back to 2007, it takes some transaction volume metrics, some pricing metrics. I think things like CPPI from Green Street, transaction volume. It will take some public market measures. Things like the VIX is a really good real-time indicator. REIT pricing is a good real-time indicator. And we also incorporate capital formation metrics. So dry powder, fundraising, time to fundraise, things like that. And all of these are in roughly equal blend. The deal volume metrics are weighted a little higher. There's some lending metrics in there as well. And are weighted across these sort of sub-metrics and give the roll-up to the ISM style aggregate index I mentioned earlier. And we track this back to 2007 through the fourth quarter of 2025. We'll be doing the first quarter reading sometime, probably in May. That's when we get enough data to do the next reading.
Excellent. Now, if you could share, what is the most recent reading telling us about the environment? And maybe how did that change throughout 2025?
So the most recent reading was actually the highest we've observed since the onset of the rate hike cycle. So the most recent reading was 64 out of 100. So things are improving and improving at a good clip. Now, a reminder for everyone, this is pre-geopolitical disruption and all of that. So this does not factor this in. This is as of end of fourth quarter. But it improved throughout the course of mid to late 2024 and into 2025. In fact, I think it's seven consecutive quarters. It's improved quarter over quarter, the index. So U.S. liquidity conditions are improving. I mentioned the loan volume is something we've been tracking now for quite some time, ticking higher in terms of loan issuance. And then we saw transaction volume really, primary market transaction volume from RCA data pick up in the fourth quarter. And the public markets at the time that this index is capturing were very healthy. So everything was kind of working in concert. I will say the one sub part of the index that remains a laggard in the US is that capital formation part of the cycle. Dry powder is still down from peak levels. And if you will get sort of time to raise a fund and how long that takes, it's still near record long amounts of time. So there's definitely still some overhang in the capital formation part of the capital cycle.
Now, I know you've been tracking this index for a long time. You've been at Madison for a while. Are there any periods in time where the index tells you something different than what kind of prevailing sentiment might be?
Yeah, we see it a little more on the European version, but there was a period, if you go back to, I think it was 2015, when the aggregate U.S. economy is pretty healthy, but there was the Bakken, you know, the sort of oil sell-off.
Yeah.
And oil prices, and there's a regional recession around oil at that time. And the liquidity index actually reflects that, but you don't really see it in any of the aggregate transaction volume metrics you would look at. And that was just more of a function of, it looks like loan volume and distress picked up a little bit if you go back to those time periods. And so the index picked that up and was a little bit off cycle with what the general headline sentiment would have been. But otherwise, it does a really good job of just quantifying shifts. And that's what we really use it for, is what's going on under the hood. And I really use it for what parts of the liquidity cycle are functioning and what parts aren't. Is there specific underlying strategies that could be more applicable right now, given what's going on in these subcomponents?
Now, if you were to give us a bit of a preview, what do you expect to see in the next reading, maybe just directionally based on what's happened over the last kind of month and a half?
Yeah. So we know the private market metrics will deteriorate. The VIX is higher than it was at year end and REIT prices are lower. So we know those will be drags on the Q1 reading. I'm not sure what will go on with the private market transaction volume. I don't have a good read on that right now, but I would imagine that we're going to continue to see weakness in the capital formation submetrics, particularly the region of the distress being the Middle East is a key region for capital formation for the industry. And it's going to be disruptive. Further disruptive than the already slow environment had been to date.
Gotcha. Now, I want to dig a little bit more specifically into deal flow and some of the more kind of just a little more into the weeds about secondaries. Now, stepping back a little bit, do you mind walking us through what a typical transaction might be for Madison? Is this an LP who wants out of a fund early? Is it a GP trying to recapitalize? Is it just a buyout? What does your deal funnel actually look like?
So it does vary a lot because we do source across all these different sorts of liquidity needs. Our most typical is a LP recapitalization. So it's typically, let's use a hypothetical example. JV owns a multifamily building, and one of the partners in that JV structure needs liquidity. They suddenly need to put their kid through college or something, or whatever it may be. They have a tax issue and they need to meet that. And they will come to us and say, I own this fractional interest in this apartment building. Are you interested? We will get full financials and underwrite it, do a full property level underwriting. We will then also do some governance discussion and discovery. What are the rights? What are they up for negotiation? And then that sort of kicks off the process. Internally, we have a very robust and regimented investment process where things have to go through certain committees and get votes in order to keep progressing. But that's what a typical deal looks like, is someone has a liquidity need and a joint venture type structure. And we begin the underwriting process very detailed. If you think about the way typically fund secondaries work, where you get very limited information, it's not like that at all. We get full property level underwriting information and do a full underwrite to our own value to figure that out.
I read a little that GP-led secondaries have become a pretty fast-growing segment of the market. Why do you think that is? And does that change the risk profile of some of the deals for you guys?
Yeah, I think they've become a little more in vogue. One, I think if you've got a very successful investment, there's a hesitation to let go of that. And so it naturally leads to continuation vehicles and things like that. I think the other thing is certain sectors and the growth in those sectors have lent themselves to that more. I'm thinking specifically of data centers right now. We've participated in data center continuation vehicles, and it's because the growth is, you know, when the original business plan was conceived, the growth tail of that sector was not as long or robust as originally envisioned. And so you get to the point where you would normally be thinking about realization, and it's, well, there's all this growth still on the table. Why would I do that? Let's give people the option to get liquidity if they want, and continue to fund this growth and hold on to it. And so we've done that in the data center space, and it tends to be more of a sector specific thing for us, where we think those growth prospects more align with the structure on offer.
And do you think some of that is just simply those deals are a lot larger, maybe some other property types where, you know, thinking shopping malls, office parks, where valuations are huge, and this might be common there as well?
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. These asset classes are larger check sizes, which skews the dollar perception of it. But that said, GP-led recaps is definitely a growing part. Again, similar to the conversation earlier, where I think it's a long-term trend as rising as a part of the market with a cyclical tailwind owing to the growth in some of these sectors that are really adding to it.
Now, another big component to this is pricing and valuation. So I think, you know, buyers are often acquiring interests at a discount to NAV, but you have your kind of appraisal lag, as some folks call it, in private real estate. So how do you guys get comfortable with where some of these assets sit? I know you said you have an extensive underwriting process, but I'm curious to hear a little more on that.
It's a great question. And, you know, so we underwrite every deal that we bring in the shop, full due diligence at the property level. And we determine our own view of NAV. And we like to enter at a discount to our own view of NAV. So not to sponsors' proposal of value. When we quote discounts, we quote them typically to our own view of value. So that starts with figuring out what the value is and then where can we transact is a second layer to that sort of decision process.
Then, and I'll ask you this, is do you think there's a particular property type where there is a big gap between appraised NAV? You know, is office the big culprit here, or is there any other sector where you think there's a big difference?
I think it's gotten a lot better in the last few quarters and year. The gaps between appraisal and our perception of valuation were wider definitely a year or two ago, and things have narrowed. But to your point, I think office is the sector where value is really in the eye of the beholder. And it's just because there's so many different paths it can take, depending on who is looking at it and what the rent roll is like, what the building is like. So office is one where there's definitely a wide, you know, we haven't transacted in office since the pandemic, I want to say, definitely not in the US. So it's been a while since we've transacted in the office sector. And that's been a tactical decision to focus on sectors that have higher growth potential.
Right. Now, if you could share, what kind of discounts are you seeing, or discounts to NAV are you seeing sellers accept? And has this changed over the last 18 to 24 months, do you think?
It's a great question. And it varies a lot by sector. If you think about data centers, there's very thin discounts. And if anything, the discount is more of a function of the growth of the platform over the time you're conducting the transaction diligence. In other sectors like office, the discounts can be significantly wider because there's significantly more need for capital. But again, we're not really transacting in that sector at the current moment. It's definitely changed over time. But part of that is because less a reflection of liquidity improving or there being a narrowing, and more just that sellers' valuations have ticked lower over time. And as a result, mathematically, discounts compress as those valuations change. So it's definitely come down since the initial rate hike cycle began, but there's still healthy discounts in a lot of sectors.
But it is widely dispersed by property type, by sector.
By property type, and it can even vary down to the individual asset level. It's a liquidity needs business, and the need for liquidity can be very acute just on individual minute factors. So it can really get highly variable quickly.
Now, is it different by geography too? Do you see some markets where this is different than others?
I would say, you know, going back to the multifamily thing we were talking about earlier, in the Sun Belt, it's a little easier to achieve discount right now, given the overhang supply has created on fundamentals, than it is in a market like the Midwest, where fundamentals have stayed healthy throughout and that sort of cap rate vintage compression phenomenon didn't happen as much. So in a sector like that, which has had really disparate regional outcomes and performance, you can definitely see it varying by market.
Now, you've mentioned seniors, you've mentioned data centers. What are some of the, and even multi, but what are some of the other sectors that are driving a lot of deal flow right now? Do you see, is there something that's coming to the table that you guys might not even be interested in that's coming more frequently now? Or
we have been seeing a little bit more of retail deal flow recently. Okay. Lifestyle, power centers, things like that in the suburbs. We've seen a good amount of deal flow on that. We've done in some separate managed accounts. We've done a few transactions in the retail sector recently for the first time in a while, but nothing in our flagship fund series yet.
Now, I mean, retail is an incredibly fragmented market right up there with self-storage or something, a lot of family operators. Yeah. What do you think is the reason that they're coming to you guys now?
Well, you know, once you transact in the sector, you attract more deal flow. And we've done that. We've done some retail transactions recently. So that's part of it. And I think another part of it is retail, you know, a colleague of mine likes to joke there can only be one hated sector at a time, and it was retail, and now it's office. And so now that office is bearing that stigma, retail can get a little bit more time and attention from the marketplace.
And I think there are a lot of parallels to retail in the 2010s to office now, in the sense that nobody's building it. You didn't have really any new retail supply following 2009. But the fundamentals are still there for some of these assets. So maybe it'll just take time for, I don't know what'll be the hated asset when office comes back, but I'm curious to know what you think.
It's a great question. I still think office has some headwinds in front of it, particularly as we figure out what the labor market impacts from AI could wind up being. Office absorption and employment growth are very tightly correlated, historically. So definitely would want to get a handle on that outcome first, and that seems highly uncertain.
I got a couple other questions for you as we look ahead. Real estate secondaries represent a fairly small share of total NAV changing hands every year. Do you think this market has a little more runway to take market share out of the total dollars spent in CRE each year? I'm just curious what you think about the future.
Yeah, at the risk of talking my book, I like to think so. And I think the big reason is, you know, we talked earlier about the fundraising cycle being still very disrupted. That doesn't mean people are going to suddenly pause the need for liquidity and the need to realize investments in some way, even if it's partially. And so what we believe is a potential outcome here is that as fundraising and capital formation remains in stasis or slowed, it's going to be hard for new vehicles to form to then continue the transaction cycle. And so as that remains disrupted, there will be an increasing need for secondaries to fill in the gap that otherwise would have been filled by new vehicle formation that can occur.
So if we're sitting here in 5 years, what do you think the secondaries market looks like?
It's larger. It's definitely larger. I had an economics professor at Duke that always said, give a forecast of price or time, but never both at the same time. So I'll say it's larger in 5 years from now, but I don't know exactly how much larger.
So if you're a CRE professional listening to our conversation, you've never interacted with the secondaries market as a GP, LP, operator, what would you want them to take away from our conversation?
There are a lot of flexible capital solutions to whatever problem you may be facing or whatever you might be trying to optimize. And so think creatively, consider secondaries in all their forms. And there's definitely other paths to the traditional market out there.
Now, we've been talking a lot about the U.S. market, but it's very different everywhere else. I'm sure it's growing at different rates in different parts of the world. One thing I wanted to ask you while we still have some time is, how does this differ across geographies? Is there something particular to the U.S. market that makes it different, or is the dynamic fundamentally different in Europe or Asia?
So we don't invest in Asia currently, so I can't speak to that, but definitely some differences between the U.S. and Europe. One, the U.S. is just larger and more institutional, and so it creates a little bit of a different landscape in terms of who you're interacting with day to day, and it's a larger, more institutionalized market. Europe is a little more fragmented. It's a little further behind the U.S. in institutionalization, and there's less transparency when it comes to things like data and information, I find, than the U.S. data providers, who are a little bit more robust. So there's some definite differences there. I would say the other major difference is just if you think about the fundamental cycles of the sectors themselves, we tend to see trends first emerge in the U.S. and then migrate to Europe. So think e-commerce started in the U.S., then became a big trend in Europe's industrial market a few years after that. And we're seeing it with data centers right now, more of a U.S.-focused sector, and now coming over to Europe in the flat D markets and some of the secondary markets. So that's the other way it tends to flow as well, as we see the fundamentals and the secular behavioral trends emerge in the U.S., and then the European operating fundamentals tend to follow a few years after.
Gotcha. Very interesting. Chris, I think I've exhausted a lot of my questions for you. So I'm going to ask you the one that we do ask all of our guests who appear on the show. Now, you've been in CRE and in data for a long time. If you could snap your fingers and change anything about the industry, just immediately have it come true, what would that be?
So this one goes to my fellow data nerds out there. I would abolish Excel completely and migrate everything into Python and other coding languages. Excel is super frustrating, and our entire industry lives on it, and it's a bedrock of the industry. And yes, I would get rid of Excel if I could snap my fingers tomorrow.
Excellent. Chris, thank you. I think that's all the time we've got. Appreciate you joining us today. And a big thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Take care until the next episode of CRE Exchange.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.